wrist screen. Let's go, Fowler mutters.
He sets off at a brisk pace.
I'm not the only one ready to get out of here.
We slip into the back of Fowler's car and it creeps out of the parking lot. For the first time in nearly 20 years, I'm out of prison. It's a surreal feeling, almost euphoric. I have questions for Fowler, but they can wait. I stare out the window like a kid seeing a foreign land for the first time. The road is crumbling. The ride is rough as any dirt road I've ever been on. There's an abandoned car every 100 yards. In a golden field, drones dart like hummingbirds around a giant combine the size of a 2-story mansion. The machine lumbers through the field, doing the harvesting work of 1,000 people. The farmhouse sits on a hill, roof caved in, paint all chipped away to reveal rotting boards. The next house I see is the same, and so is the next.
Everyone moving to the cities?
Pretty much, Fowler says, sounding weary.
I don't want to sound ungrateful, but I'm wondering why you got me out.
For a job.
The only job I've done for the last few decades has been the laundry. I'm assuming it's not that.
It's a job you're uniquely suited for,
Fowler adds, sensing my apprehension. How does this work? Like a work release? I do some time and get a pardon or something?
Let's just say if you accept the offer, you won't need to worry about a pardon.
At the Edgefield Airport, we board an airship emblazoned with the logo for Sentinel Aerospace. That I also didn't see coming. In the air, I once again peer out the window. The world below is a patchwork of golden fields, green forests, and dark blue ponds and lakes. Crumbling roads divide the color blocks like threads in a quilt, occasionally meeting at the ruins of an abandoned town. The buildings are flattened or falling. Stray dogs wander the streets. The ghost towns are like gouges in the earth, stains left where humans dug in, sucked the planet dry, and left without cleaning up. On the horizon, I spot massive towers and launch pads.
Johnson Space Center.
Used to be,
Fowler says quietly, looking down on the sprawling complex. What is it now, a Disney park?
VR killed the theme park.
Fowler pauses.
This is private property now, owned by Sentinel Aerospace.
You're kidding.
Wish I was, Fowler whispers.
It clicks then, where I've heard his name. You used to work for NASA. You were the
director once upon a time.
And now?
He exhales and attempts a quiet laugh.
Now I'm an independent contractor.
For Sentinel Aerospace.
Correct.
He stares at the launch pads below, a somber expression on his face. Inside the main building, Fowler leads me into a conference room, where 6 people are waiting, all about my age. I scan their faces, looking for clues to who they are and why I'm here. None of them are VR heads, I can tell that much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. James Sinclair, robotics expert.
The man closest to me introduces himself first.
Grigory Sokolov, astronautical and electrical engineer.
The Asian man next to him nods curtly.
Min Zhao, pilot and navigator, extensive EVA experience, specializing in ship repair.
The woman beside him smiles.
Izumi Tanaka, physician.
I'm Charlotte Lewis, says a woman with an Australian accent.
The older man sitting next to her smiles.
It's good to see you again, James. Don't know if you remember me, but I'm Harry Andrews. I escaped the old folks' home, and I've been hanging around building drones and tinkering with ship's systems.
Ship's systems. Before I can ask about that, the final team member introduces herself.
And I'm Emma Matthews. I did 6 tours on the ISS. EVA specialist.
Fowler fixes her with a proud gaze.
Emma is selling herself a little short. She'll be the mission director. She's been the lead planner for the colony.
Chapter 53. James. Colony? I repeat, trying to understand what I've just heard.
As in, lunar colony?
That draws amused smiles from the team and an eye roll from Grigory.
The plan is a bit more ambitious than that,
Fowler says, closing the door to the room. Besides, Emma says,
There are 1,000 lunar VR programs, everything from survival dramas to lunar sports to murder mysteries. A real colony would be boring in comparison.
So what are we talking about?
We're talking, Fowler says, turning to face me, about a colony completely outside our solar system.
For a moment, I'm speechless. It does make sense now, why I wouldn't need a pardon.
Fowler taps at his tablet. On the conference room screen, an image of space appears. A yellow-orange star burns in the distance, growing larger as what I assume is a probe draws closer. 3 tiny planets orbit close to the star, none of them rotating, one side always facing the light. The video zooms in on one planet, which couldn't be more alien. Half is covered in ice, the other half a vast desert, a ring of green separating the two sides. It's bizarre.
The star is a red dwarf, Fowler says. Kepler-42.
You sent a probe there? I ask. Grigori hangs his head and massages his eyebrows as if he's just heard the stupidest thing in history.
No, Fowler says carefully. Kepler-42 is 131 light-years from Earth.
The video's a simulation, Harry says, based on telescope imagery. Had to make a fake video, so it would seem more real to the board. Numbers and still images are boring.
Fowler points at the screen.
The plan, simply put, is to establish a human colony on the second planet in the system, which we're calling Aurora, after the Latin word for dawn. Its disparate climates and dwarf star also provide an excellent setting for research.
Incredible, I whisper.
I'm sure you have a million questions, Fowler says.
More like billions and billions, I reply, trying to figure out what to ask first.
How do we get there? When? What do you need from me?
Emma takes the tablet from Fowler, and a second later the screen shifts to an image of 2 massive ships docked with the ISS. 6 smaller ships float nearby, like rowboats in the shadow of an aircraft carrier.
The Aurora mission has been in the works in some form for almost 3 decades now. It's been funded by governments and the world's largest corporations, and to some extent by wealthy families who don't want to see their children grow up on Earth, who want to see their descendants live on a world without VR and the other problems that plague our planet, who want a more simple life. What you're seeing is the most tangible result of the project. 2 colony ships, Bollard and McTavish.
I try to place the names, but I can't recall any scientists or politicians with those names.
Fowler leans close to me. Humbly named after Sentinel's chair and vice chair of the board.
Of course, I mutter.
But what's more incredible, Emma continues, is the work no one sees, especially some of the breakthroughs Izumi and her team have achieved, Harry's work on the drones, and Grigori's propulsion technology. We've also given a lot of thought to how to increase the probability of mission success.
The screen changes to a tiled montage of dozens of stars, and then planets of every color in the rainbow.
Aurora is our top candidate for colonization. We've identified dozens of others. Bollard and McTavish will be ready to leave Earth in 5 years, give or take. They will disembark together, but take different paths to Aurora. Redundancy increases the likelihood of success. The plan is for them to arrive at roughly the same time. However, there's a chance we may not even stop at Aurora.
That surprises me.
I'll let Harry explain,
Emma says, stepping away from the screen.
Can't wait to show you Drones Are Us, Harry says, taking the tablet from Emma.
Drones Are Us?
The drone lab. We've got scout drones, repair drones, big drones, little drones, mother drones.
Harry, Emma says quietly.
He shrugs.
Sorry, I have a tendency to drone on.
Emma exhales heavily, as Grigori shakes his head, mumbling something in Russian. It's a pretty bad joke. A dad joke. But it lightens the mood and somehow makes me like Harry already.
What do these drones do?
Harry taps the tablet, and the screen changes to show a simulation of a drone in space ejecting a small object.
We launched the first scout drone almost 20 years ago. It has a single mission, to travel the path our ships will take to Kepler-42, measure the solar output we'll encounter along the way, and estimate the amount of loose matter near the route, and of course, watch for any other issues. Borg, Species 8472, Cylons.
Harry, Emma says once again.
I suppress a laugh, then ask, "How do you get the data? How far would a broadcast carry?"
"Too far, probably," Harry says. "You never know when a cloaked Klingon bird of prey might be."
He stops in mid-sentence, realizing Emma is staring at him. Harry spreads his hands.
"Let's just say transmissions might be picked up by the wrong party. The small objects the scouts eject are data bricks. When the ships leave Earth, they will encounter these devices, sort of like breadcrumbs along the path, bonbons with data inside. They'll give us an idea of what we might encounter, in particular matter and solar output, which are vitally important for propulsion."
"Correct," Grigori says. "The ships will use fusion reactors with solar power backup."
I expect Grigori to say more, but he leaves it there, as if explaining would be a waste of time. He's probably right. "Propulsion fuel will be the least of our mechanical challenges," Emma says. "This is going to be a long journey. How long, we're not even sure. We do know that the ship will need maintenance, and maybe even a complete overhaul along the way." She makes eye contact with me. "And that's where you come in, James."
"Me? Ship's mechanic?"
"Not exactly. Before we get to that, I think Izumi should outline how we're going to make the trip." Izumi takes the tablet and brings up an image on the screen of a person in what looks like a deflated plastic bag. They're practically shrink-wrapped. "During the Melong pandemic, a company called Lazarus Biosciences stumbled onto what worked as a sort of temporary cure." "Incredible. I've never heard about it." Izumi reads the shock on my face. "As I said, it was sort of a cure. Lazarus developed a therapy called Telorica that was FDA approved for use in cancer treatment. The retroviral therapy worked by essentially slowing the patient's metabolism, delaying the shortening of telomeres, and a few other things. In the context of cancer treatment, it stopped the clock on tumor growth. It was a very expensive medication, but many of the rich and famous started using it off-label, in higher doses, as an anti-aging therapy. It worked, but it had some side effects, cognitive sluggishness chief among them. Most Hollywood stars would take high doses of the drug when they weren't working, then stop taking it when a new shoot started. The brain fog usually cleared in a few days."
I shake my head. "That's crazy. That's Hollywood," Harry says. "People paying through the nose to be unaging zombies."
"The problem," Izumi says, "was what happened when someone taking Telorica contracted Melong fever. Melong, as you may know, is a viral hemorrhagic fever, similar to Ebola, but with the communicability of the worst flu strain in history. It also featured an abnormally long asymptomatic period, a period in which the host is also contagious. Whereas most individuals who contracted Melong showed symptoms 8 to 12 days after contracting the virus, those taking Telorica didn't get sick for over 2 months."
"That's why I never heard of it."
"Exactly," Izumi replies. "The Melong pandemic burned itself out in 3 weeks. When the Telorica patients started getting sick, it looked like the start of a second outbreak, which would have caused a panic. The government quarantined the subjects and figured out what happened. So did the families. Melong usually kills within 96 hours of the first symptoms. Telorica patients, even after discontinuing the drug, wasted away for weeks. Some very rich and powerful people watched their loved ones suffer the worst kind of death because of that drug. A lawsuit was filed, but it never went to trial. The damages for pain and suffering would have been enormous. Lazarus liquidated voluntarily. They put all their IP up for sale and paid everything out to the families. As you might imagine, Telorica garnered little interest on the auction block. Sentinel, however, saw the potential for its use and bought it for almost nothing." Izumi takes a deep breath and turns back to the screen, staring at the image of the person in the bag. "And I've been working on it since, almost 13 years. My best guess is that we'll finish our trials in a few years."
"Trials of what?"
"Stasis. We've had 200 participants in a state of zero bodily function for 16 months now, with no adverse reactions. We're confident, but we want to be sure it's safe." "That," Emma says, "is the plan for the colonists. They'll enter stasis here on Earth, and exit once the colony is established on Aurora. As I said before, maintaining the ships to get them there becomes the problem." She takes the tablet from Izumi and brings up the image of the massive colony ships. The image zooms in, focusing on the 6 smaller ships. "We call these support vessels auxiliaries. They're essentially floating factories, repair ships for the colony ships. They can print nearly every part of the colony ships. And when they need more material, they're capable of mining asteroids for whatever they can't scoop up in space. Given enough time and material, the three auxiliaries could practically rebuild the colony ships. And they stock spares for the parts they can't print. What they won't have on board is any colonists or stasis capabilities. That's why you're here, James. I nod.
You want me to automate the ships?
Yes.
I study the ships on the screen, trying to choose my words with care. Look, I'm blown away by all this. It's incredible. If you're asking me to be a part of it, I say yes. This is the best offer I've had in a while. The only offer, actually. But I want to be up front with you. I've been living a pretty low-tech life for the last 20 years. To say I've been out of the field of robotics and artificial intelligence is an understatement. I don't even know if I would recognize the state of technology today.
You'd be surprised, Emma says. It turns out in the years after the Malong pandemic and the explosion of VR, progress in the area of artificial intelligence and robotics slowed drastically. Some due to a lack of interest, but mostly because governments around the world passed laws limiting AI and robotics in an effort to boost employment and reignite consumer spending. Well, spending on things besides VR apps. Emma pauses, smiling sympathetically at me. And frankly, people saw what happened when someone pushed the boundaries of that frontier. No one wanted to end up in prison for the rest of their life. The room falls silent. Everyone looks away from me. I feel like a kid on his first day at a new school. A kid with a secret he hopes no one knows. A kid who's just figured out that his new classmates knew all along. In a way, I'm glad it's out of the bag. No more dancing around it. I'm a convicted felon. Either accept it or they don't. Harry finally ends the awkwardness, his tone jovial.
You know, it's a messed up world when you can go away for 20 years and come back to find that people are even dumber and more antiquated than when you left.
That draws smiles and chuckles from around the room. Fowler clears his throat.
I want to be clear on what we're asking for, James.
I nod, and he continues.
At present, the ships are mostly automated. We have repair drones that can perform basic maintenance. But we have a huge gap in what we need. What we need, frankly, is a workforce that can think and adapt to whatever might happen during the voyage. They need to be able to react extremely quickly. And they need to be able to bear the passage of time, millennia, without complaint.
You want android crews for the auxiliaries?
Yes, Fowler says. We also want a contingent of caretakers for the colony ships. Members of the mission team will exit stasis periodically to do routine checks. But we're talking about a trip that will take thousands of years. We can't be awake for even 1% of it.
Fowler glances at Harry.
And some of us aren't exactly spring chickens.
I walk closer to the screen, studying the colony ships, still a little bit in shock. Maybe Olivia was right. My path, as strange and painful as it has been, has led me here, to what might be the most important project in human history. The whole human race is going down the drain. This could save us. A start on a new world. And I can help make it happen. Had I followed Olivia, what would my life have been like? Would I have ever discovered my true passion? I realize Emma is staring at me, a small smile on her lips.
So are you in?
I'm in. The smile widens. I do, however, have a request.
The smile slowly vanishes as she puts her hands on her waist.
Go ahead.
I hold my hands up in surrender. It's not a demand, not a condition. If the answer is no, I'm still in.
Okay.
The only family I have left is my brother, Alex Sinclair. He has a wife and 2 kids. They may be living it up somewhere, but if the world is any indication, things might not be so great for them. If it's possible, and I understand if it's not, I'd like for them to have a place on the colony ships, a shot at the new kind of beginning you're talking about on Aurora.
Fowler cuts his eyes at Emma, waiting for her decision.
Done.
Thank you.
They'll have to go through the standard screening.
I understand.
Assuming they pass, and they'll want to join the mission, we'll make room for them.
Fowler turns his chair to me.
I hate to even ask. I know you probably don't have a clear answer, but...
He nods to Izumi and Emma.
The final pieces of the mission requirements are coming together. The board is going to ask me how long it's going to take to create an android prototype, and how long production might take. He spreads his hands. Keep in mind you'll have a virtually unlimited budget and resources. With that said, how long would it take you to produce a prototype the board can review? As it turns out, I can give you a very firm timeline. Fowler nods. That's great. I can have a prototype here tomorrow, ready for testing and review. We can go into production the next day. Harry throws his head back and laughs. Told you this was a good idea! Chapter 54. James. The old ranch house outside Petaluma is about like I left it, perhaps a little more run down. Inside, I make my way to the kitchen and open the creaking door that leads down to the cellar. The narrow wooden staircase groans under my weight. At the bottom, I call out, Oscar! Can you hear me? No response. Did they find him? It's okay. It's James. If you can hear me, come out. We have to leave. I hear rustling in the corner. I turn and breathe a sigh of relief when I see him. He's okay. Unharmed. His skin is silky smooth, his hair short and brown, worn in the same fashion as mine, though he looks 40 years younger than I do, like a young man just beginning college. Sir, he says softly, I didn't know what to do. You told me to stay here until you came for me. You did the right thing. I didn't expect you to receive a life sentence. I didn't know whether to try and help you. But someone could have been harmed. Oscar, it's okay, you did the right thing. Sir, have you been released? In a sense, there's some people I want you to meet. The boardroom is dominated by a massive wooden table. 13 people sit around it. Every race is represented, and the group is nearly evenly split between men and women. Oscar stands at the end of the table, with Fowler and I on either side, watching from a few feet behind him. At the head of the table sits a man who looks to be in his 70s, heavy set, with a gorging pot belly, close-cropped white hair, and gin blossoms sprouting from his nose. He scowls at Oscar, and when he speaks, his tone is a mix of aggression and annoyance. What's your name, son?
Oscar, sir.
What are you, Oscar?
I'm an android, sir.
What do you want, Oscar?
Oscar slowly turns back to me, silently asking for help.
I'm not asking him, son, I'm asking you. And you look at me when you answer.
Oscar snaps his head around but doesn't reply. I lean forward, whispering. If you don't understand the question, say so. I do not understand the question, sir.
It's a simple question. What do you desire?
Sir, I'm sorry, but I do not...
The man slams a fist on the table and opens his mouth, but the small woman next to him holds out her palm.
Raymond, please, if I may.
You may as well, Lynn.
She's Asian, with silver-white hair pulled into a tight bun on the back of her head.
Oscar, are there... rules that you operate by? Rules that you cannot break, no matter what?
Yes, ma'am.
What are they?
I have 3 root directives, ma'am. First, to preserve human life at all costs. Second, that if ambiguity arises around the first root directive, that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. Third, that if ambiguity arises in the execution of the first and second root directives, that younger lives must be preserved before older lives.
So, Raymond says, smiling, if it was down to saving either me or some washed-up VR addict junkie who's 20 years old, you'd save the junkie?
Yes, sir. Raymond shakes his head slowly. Lynn speaks before he has a chance.
Oscar, what do you require to operate?
2 things, ma'am. Most importantly, power. Assuming I have power, I require an environment non-corrosive or otherwise damaging to my parts.
To his parts, Raymond mutters.
Oscar, Lynn says, beyond these root directives, what does your programming instruct you to do?
Help James with his research, ma'am.
And do you obey every command he gives you?
Yes, ma'am, assuming they do not conflict with the 3 root directives.
Great,
Raymond says to no one in particular.
A robot army loyal only to an ex-con mad scientist. What could go wrong?
If I may, Fowler says, getting Lynn's attention. Dr. Sinclair has agreed to rewrite the core programming for Oscar and any other androids he produces. This board will have sole control over their route directives and mission orders. Raymond looks away as if he's lost interest. Lynn seems pensive.
Oscar, can you evolve?
No, ma'am.
Why not?
I cannot reproduce, ma'am.
What I mean is, can you change? Can you enhance your own programming? Create new functions and capabilities?
Yes, ma'am. I can learn new skills and assimilate large amounts of data.
What are the limits on how you can change?
I cannot create any program that would violate the root directives or decrease my ability to perform the tasks assigned to me.
Raymond addresses the other board members. That's robot lawyer double talk, for he can do whatever he wants. Maybe these souped-up tin cans will get us to Aurora, maybe they won't. But I'll bet you if they do, they'll be so sick of babysitting humans that they'll drop us off and sail away. Or maybe put us in a cage along the way. You would, wouldn't you, Oscar?
Yes, sir.
Half the room gasps. Involuntarily, I step forward, whispering to Oscar,
tell them why you do that.
If the first root directive compelled me, if a human was in danger, and I had to put that person in a cage to save them, I would do so.
Well, I've heard enough, Raymond says. By God, I hope the rest of you have too.
A few minutes later, we're standing outside in the hall. The doors to the boardroom closed. Fowler and I pace, trying to listen. Oscar stares impassively. I feel like a parent who's just watched their child receive an unfair trial, and now I'm waiting for the verdict. It's nearly unbearable. The doors open, and Lynn walks out.
The vote was 7-6. Gentlemen, your plan is approved.
Housing at the Sentinel Center is sort of like the best apartment I had during grad school. Perfectly fine, but nothing luxurious. Compared to prison, the one-bedroom abode is a palace. For the past week, I've been working with Harry and Oscar to expand the drone lab for android design and manufacture. Harry has officially taken down his crude Drones R Us banner, replacing it with one that reads, 7 of 9 Designs. Across the hall, Grigori works day and night on the engines for our drones and obsesses over the operating efficiency of the ship's engines. There's a small picture hanging on the wall of a woman younger than him.
His daughter? I asked Harry one day.
Wife, Lena.
Is she?
Died during the Malong pandemic. She was part of the team then. They were going to Aurora together. He hasn't been the same since.
That insight helps me understand Grigori a little more. Of all the team members, he's been the most standoffish toward me. He's afraid to get emotionally involved with anyone again. I know exactly how he feels. What it's like to plan a life with someone, and see that dream ripped away. It was like that with Olivia for me. The fact that Grigori is still here tells me something about him as well. He doesn't give up on his friends and his team. At the moment, I'm starting to wonder if I'm the weakest link in that team. Some things have changed since I went to prison. At the time of my incarceration, robotics parts were fairly easy to come by. Between the U.S. and Asia, there were countless electronics manufacturers able to produce small batch projects. I would send out my specs, have bids within 24 hours, and the parts would be in production the next day. But today, nothing new is being produced. Mostly just replacements for what the world has and is using up. I was hoping to get the parts for the androids manufactured from a few vendors, separating the order so no one could tell what we're building. But that's going to be impossible. We're going to have to manufacture and assemble everything here. It's doable, but it will take time. The good news is that with every android we complete, our workforce grows by one. Soon those androids will be multiplying at an exponential rate. I'm in my apartment, lying on the couch and reading my tablet when there's a knock at the door. I open it, expecting to see either Oscar or Harry. We've been working up a list of VR controller boards we could adapt for the androids. It's neither of them. It's Emma. She's the last person I expected to see at 7 at night.
Hi,
she says, looking tired. Hi. She glances around. Can I...
come in?
I throw the door open.
Yes, of course. Sorry, I'm not used to getting visitors.
I scan the room quickly, making sure it's fit for company. I move 3 empty meal cartons off the coffee table. 2 were today's breakfast and last night's dinner. Can't place the 3rd. I wonder if she can smell that.
Please have a seat.
She settles into the couch, and I drag a chair from the small square table by the window.
You want anything to drink?
No, thank you, though. She inhales as if gathering her courage. I have an update on your request.
Alex's family.
Yes. The good news is that Alex and Abby have agreed to join the mission. Enthusiastically, I might add.
That's good. Great! Does that mean Jack and Sarah are the bad news?
I'm very sorry to have to tell you this, James. But Jack died in the Malong pandemic. I stand and pace toward the kitchen. It's a gut punch on so many levels. Alex must still hate me if he wouldn't even tell me Jack died. I could have gone to the funeral. Surely they would have let me out. And Sarah? I ask, dreading the answer.
She's alive,
Emma says quickly, turning back to face me. She said no.
I'm surprised Alex and Abby would agree to leave Earth without her.
I think they may have given up on her. She's a VR addict, James. She's in a bad way. They send her money for food each week. At their request, Sentinel agreed to set up a fund that will continue those payments.
She doesn't work?
No, nothing regular. She gives plasma. They pay her a small fee for it, and give her access to a huge VR library while the blood is being drawn. She volunteers for medical trials, too. I lean back against the counter and close my eyes, wishing it weren't true, wishing I could have done something. If you want to talk about what to do about Sarah later, I understand.
What do you mean, she won't go? What can we do?
We can make it happen.
I don't follow.
I have to give Izumi credit for the idea. We have 3 active clinical trials for stasis. We simply recruit Sarah, put her in stasis, and take her with us. She'll wake up on Aurora. Izumi will record it as an adverse event. She'll issue a death certificate and there won't be any issues. She doesn't think it will hurt trial recruitment. I search her face, trying to figure out if this is a really bad joke or if she's serious. I can't even imagine how many laws that would break.
It will save her life. I've seen addicts like her. She has a few years left, at best.
You went to see her yourself?
She nods.
I visited Alex and Abby, too.
I'm shocked that she took the time, and that Izumi is willing to do this for my family. These people barely know me, and they're willing to risk their freedom to save my niece.
For the first time in a very long time, I feel like I'm a part of something really special. As of this moment, these people are more than my team. I still believe I was wrongfully convicted, but I learned a lot about human nature from my mistake. I know what I have to do now.
It's not my call to make.
Emma bunches her eyebrows, confused. Alex and Abby have to agree. It's their daughter. At 7 of 9 Designs, things move slowly at first, as Harry, Oscar, and I work out our production process. Then all of a sudden, we seem to turn the corner. 4 androids are rolling off the line each week, and drones are multiplying like robotic hamsters. One day right after lunch, Emma drops by the lab.
Interest you in a shiny new drone, ma'am? Harry says.
I'm all stocked up, Emma replies, smiling. Just came by to see James.
Harry raises his eyebrows theatrically and glances over at Oscar. Let's give these 2 young people some privacy, Oz.
Very funny,
I call to him as they walk out. Emma blushes a little. I feel like a middle schooler.
Everything okay?
Yes. Just wanted to let you know that what we talked about regarding Sarah is done.
Good, thank you. Any issues?
Nothing we couldn't handle. After work, I walk to Emma's apartment and stand outside the door debating. No, I should go home. I already said thank you. She's probably tired after work. Probably not even home. It was a bad idea. The door opens and she takes a step into the hall, head down. She practically jumps when she realizes I'm standing there.
James,
she says quickly, bringing a hand to her chest.
I didn't see you. It's my fault. I was... Wait. What were you doing? Were you going out?
For dinner. Did you need to see me?
Not exactly. I mean, yes, I was just coming to say thank you again for what you did for Sarah.
You're welcome.
I should just turn and leave, but I'm paralyzed for some reason, standing there staring at her growing smile, completely surprised by what she says next.
You want to get some dinner?
I expected the launch of the Sentinel fleet to be the biggest news event of the century. But on the day we embarked on our journey, the live-streaming video of the ships leaving orbit attracts a mere 62,000 viewers, enough to land it at number 193 on the most-watched videos of the day, right behind the preview for a VR drama titled Gator Kane 13, Swamp Apocalypse. It's an interactive story, where a massive hurricane pushes into the Florida Everglades, flooding the state with water, bringing with it irritated, hungry alligators, and a horrifying ensemble cast of snakes. The VR participants and their online friends must run and swim and work together to escape the various swamp creatures brought inland. That's the world we're leaving. A swamp apocalypse preview is more interesting than humanity boldly venturing out into the universe. On the bridge of the McTavish, I watch Earth grow smaller on the viewscreen. Emma's beside me. Oscar stands behind us, still as a statue. But I know he's wirelessly interfacing the ship's systems, running checks and double checks on every last component. I've learned a lot about Emma over the last 3 years. Starting a colony on a new world has been her lifelong dream. In so many ways, she's like Olivia, driven, uncompromising, and passionate. But Emma opted to bring me along on the ship, and I couldn't be happier to be here.
"I bet I've imagined this moment a million times," she says.
"Is it everything you thought it would be?"
She looks away from the screen. "It's different. When we started planning the mission, it was about pushing the boundaries of what was possible. It was going to be a triumph, humanity advancing into the galaxy to seek a new challenge. Now it feels different.
Like we're retreating, not advancing."
"Exactly. The mission is really about survival now."
"To me, that makes it even more worth doing."
She seems to consider that for a moment.
"True."
Turning to me, she asks, "When are you going into stasis?"
"Thought I'd stay up to see Mars and the asteroid belt, live."
"Me too."
"We've got some time."
Emma raises her eyebrows.
"We've got a million hours of old TV shows and movies to watch. Or we could play cards."
"Let's do both. Cards until we're too tired, and TV until we're ready to go to sleep." The following 2 months, the happiest I've been in a very long time. It feels like we're the last two people in the world, alone, without a single worry. Everyone else is in stasis. Oscar and three other androids maintain the ship. Emma and I talk for hours on end, play cards, and enjoy every meal together. We're like two planets orbiting each other, our gravity pulling us together slowly. She's been alone for a long time. So have I. What she's feeling exactly, I don't know. For me, it's an indescribable mix of excitement and fear. On the bridge, the viewscreen shows live images of the dwarf planet Ceres. It's gray and pockmarked like the moon. Somehow it feels strangely anticlimactic. Maybe it's because I know Emma's going to stasis after we pass. I might as well, too. In the corridor on the way to the med bay, she says, "I was thinking I would have Oscar wake me in 1,000 years to get an update."
"I'll do the same."
She smiles. "It's a date."
For me, the next 1,000 years pass like an afternoon nap. I wake in the med bay to find Emma staring down at me.
"Good morning."
"Morning. Looks like we're still here."
"Apparently."
Oscar steps into the med bay.
"Welcome back, sir."
"Feels like I haven't even been gone. What did I miss?"
"That may be difficult to explain, sir."
"Are we safe? What's our status?"
"For the moment, I believe we are safe, sir."
"Tell us over breakfast, then."
On the bridge, Emma and I devour 2 MREs, while Oscar stands before the viewscreen, showing an animation of the ship and the 3 auxiliaries, as well as a massive fleet of drones. Approximately 800 years into our journey, the McTavish, Auxiliary 2, and 17 scout drones were affected by a quantum anomaly.
"What kind of anomaly?"
Emma asks. A bombardment, ma'am, of subatomic particles. We detected tetraquarks and gravitons, though we believe there may have been other particles undetectable by our sensors.
Did they harm the ship?
No, ma'am, not directly.
Emma cocks her head at the answer.
What did you do? I ask.
We ran, sir. We accelerated to the ship's limit, and when we rejoined the auxiliaries ahead, we reinforced the ships against future quantum bombardment. We also manufactured scout drones with more advanced subatomic measurement capabilities. We have widened our patrol perimeter.
You did the right thing, Emma says. What do you believe the bombardment was? A scan from an alien entity?
Perhaps, ma'am. However, it may have also been a natural stellar phenomenon previously unknown to us. There's something else I must tell you. We believe the gravitons, and perhaps other as yet unidentified subatomic particles, altered the gravitational force acting on the ships and drones they impacted.
Emma's eyes go wide. I'm guessing this is bad news.
To what degree?
She asks. Unfortunately, ma'am, we are not completely sure. Based on what happened after the particles passed, we believe the anomaly created a pocket of stronger gravity, strong enough to materially alter the geometry of space-time around the affected vessels.
Emma stands and paces away, deep in thought. I'm way out of my element here.
Can one of you translate that for me?
Emma seems far away as she answers. A clock on Earth records less time than one on the ISS, by a very small degree. The clock on Earth is subject to stronger gravity, so it runs slower.
Emma pauses.
How long, Oscar?
When we rejoined the two auxiliaries and drones not bombarded by the particles, we learned that they had experienced the passage of 17,992 years.
Chapter 55. James. For a long moment, neither Emma nor I say anything. Oscar stands on the bridge waiting. Finally, I break the silence.
I want to make sure I understand.
Emma and Oscar both turn to me.
You're telling me we just hit some kind of speed bump in space-time that slowed us down?
An apt analogy, sir, Oscar says.
Let's talk about what this means, Emma says. First off, how did the unaffected ships fare?
Well, Oscar says, we actually now have 17 auxiliaries and thousands of scout drones. Per protocol, the ships ahead of us slowed, then began producing scouts that were launched in our direction. The ships behind us were the first to make contact. When the bombardment passed, they were waiting for us. I hold up a hand.
Why couldn't they find us? Surely they could have caught up within a year or 100 years. They had 18,000.
It's a little hard to explain, Emma says. As the other ships got close to the altered space-time, they would have experienced its effect too. It's like we fell into a well, except this well is more spread out. A basketball sinking into a sheet. The people behind us can see us, they can move toward us, but as they do, the altered space-time geometry affects them too. They also fall into the well, and time slows for them.
She eyes Oscar.
I'm assuming it was only the ships ahead, who never met up with us, that experienced the greatest passage of time?
Correct, ma'am,
and your explanation is accurate based upon our current understanding of space-time. There is also the possibility that we lack the scientific understanding to fully comprehend how the phenomenon acted upon us, only the net effect, the passage of nearly 18,000 years.
Oscar's right, Emma says. For now it's a mystery of space and time, but one thing we can be certain of. If Bollard didn't experience the same phenomenon, they've probably already reached Aurora. The protocol is to wait 5,000 years. If the other ship hasn't arrived by then, they'll assume we're lost and proceed with colonization.
The next time I wake from stasis, Oscar has no surprises for us. It's the same for the next 3 times. At the check-in that marks 6,000 years into our journey, Oscar informs us that a long-range scout detected what might have been what he called a non-natural object, adrift in space. Again, the fleet ran. We'll never know if it was truly an alien object or simply a strange asteroid. We're not out here to answer the big questions of the universe. We're trying to survive. So we ran, and we keep running. But we never encounter anything else.
At the last awakening, Arthur's expression is blank, as he says, "We have arrived, sir."
Emma and I race to the bridge, where the viewscreen displays Aurora below us. The planet is exactly as we thought, half desert, half ice-covered, with a sliver of green dividing light from darkness. At the navigation station, I pull up the transponder map. I see 300 auxiliary ships and drones so thick they look like a swarm of bees. But I don't see the bollard. Oscar seems to know what I'm looking for.
They already arrived.
The bollard? When?
13,000 years ago, according to their computer.
You have access to the bollard's computer? I don't see it in orbit.
It's on the surface.
Oscar reads my confusion.
In the 20,000 years it has taken us to get here, he's made some upgrades to himself. Reading facial expressions appears to be one of them. Like our fleet, the Bollard flotilla made upgrades to their colony ship. It was able to land safely on the planet 1,000 years after they arrived.
How? Emma asks.
The auxiliaries reinforced the ship and added thrusters.
Interesting, she mumbles, thinking. If they've been here that long, where are they? Why aren't we talking to them right now?
Because they are all dead.
The words hang in the air like the aftermath of a bomb that's gone off. Harry. Fowler. Charlotte. Gone. Emma is speechless. Explain, is all I can manage.
Per the arrival protocol, we have spent the last 2 years surveying the planet, including investigating the mystery of the lost colony. The colonists from the Bollard landed their ship on the edge of the mountain range bordering the dark side of Aurora. They built a city around the ship. We see evidence of habitation for approximately 300 years, then only remains.
What killed them? I ask.
Unknown, sir. We have studied the planet intensely. There is a rogue dwarf planet in the system that exerts a gravitational pull on Aurora, temporarily altering its orbit, resulting in a substantial environmental disruption, displacing species from the desert ecosystems all the way to the tundra region. We believed at first that these climate effects and the mixing of species had brought forth a novel pathogen that decimated the population. But after extensive tests, we can find no pathogen that would have adversely affected humans on the scale observed.
What does that leave? I ask. They killed each other? An alien attack wiped them out? A predator?
There is no evidence of trauma to the last members of the colony. The bones are intact.
Emma paces the small bridge, her focus shifting from the floor to the viewscreen that shows Aurora waiting below.
Wake up the board!
You're kidding. She turns to me. We have to. What happens next is their decision to make. That's dangerous, Emma. You know what they're like.
I do, but we made an agreement with them. They fulfilled their end. They got us the resources we needed. They put their faith in us to get the ship here. Now we have to honor our promise to allow them to make the final judgment on colonization.
Emma eyes Oscar. And besides, we don't even have the authority to make the call.
I'm afraid that's true, ma'am.
Chapter 56. James.
The ship doesn't have a conference room, so we meet in the cargo bay. The board sits on the floor, and Grigori, Min, and Izumi stand off to the side, observing as Oscar, Emma, and I relate what's happened and the decision we face. When we're finished, the board is silent at first, glancing around, unsure who should speak.
Raymond McTavish looks annoyed, like someone who has actually been napping for thousands of years and has been unexpectedly woken up.
We have these huge ships, and all these baby ships.
Raymond seems to grasp for the right word.
The auxiliaries, yeah, that's it. And with all this space and technology, you can't even pack a simple folding chair? I've got to sit on this cold, hard floor?
Emma and I share a look, silently saying, that's his first question.
Sir, Oscar says, I will order the closest auxiliary to print chairs immediately. We'll bring them in through the—
You do that,
Raymond says.
After a pause, Lynn leans toward Raymond, speaking softly.
Would you prefer to wait for the chairs before we proceed?
No, go ahead.
Given these circumstances, Lynn says to us, what does the mission team see as our options?
Frankly, ma'am, there are only three options, Emma replies. The first is to simply proceed with our plan. We know Aurora is habitable. The Bollard colonists survived for 9 generations. It's unclear whether what killed them will be an issue for us, but we know we can survive down there.
Emma waits for questions, but the board members seem deep in thought, so she continues.
The second option is to keep going, to proceed to our secondary colonization candidate. The problem with that is we'd be going to a planet where we're not absolutely certain we can survive. It may be more dangerous than Aurora.
And the third option? Lynn asks.
We go back to Earth.
Raymond looks disgusted. You're kidding!
I'm merely stating the options for the survival of the colonists. The risk profile associated with the original mission has materially changed. We know humans can survive on Earth.
The Earth we left, he replies. The Earth of nearly 30,000 years ago. For all we know, Earth is a nuclear wasteland, or a water world, or an ice ball, or a barren desert. And even if the planet is just like we left it, I guarantee you the people aren't. Look at how much civilization changed in just the last 200 years before we left. We went from riding horses to walking on the moon. Can you even imagine what they're like now? Would they even recognize us? Would they see us as invaders, a threat, or a nuisance to dispose of?
The cargo bay falls silent until Oscar speaks. There is another fact that should be considered. In the course of our journey, we manufactured and deployed over 40,000 scout drones. Many were assigned long-term missions to search for threats along our path. As you know, we identified what might have been one such threat, though it made no reaction to the drone's presence. What you must know is that 49 long-range scout drones never arrived at their rendezvous locations. As such, we avoided the regions they scouted. The circumstances of their disappearance remain unknown.
You lost some drones. Who cares? Raymond says.
All of us should, Emma replies, because we don't know what happened to those drones.
Again, so what?
Raymond snaps. Emma takes a deep breath, trying to keep her voice calm. The reason they didn't return is important. Sure, they might have malfunctioned or been disabled by a natural phenomenon, but it's also possible that one or more of those drones was captured by an alien entity. If that's true, whoever or whatever captured the drone knows we're out here somewhere. I'm delighted to see Raymond speechless for once.
What information about us do the drones possess? Lynn asks.
None, ma'am, Oscar replies. Their operating system is simple, and they carried only the data they collected. However, that data may have revealed the ship's vector at the moment the drone was dispatched from the fleet. We made 6 major course adjustments, and countless minor ones during the trip. It's unlikely the drone data would lead an alien entity to us, but with a sufficiently large search radius and range, they would eventually find us. The other implication of this, Emma says, is that returning to Earth, even on an altered course, now presents a greater known risk, as does proceeding to the secondary colony world. In short, every minute we stay in space puts us in danger, even with a scout drone serving as a warning system. The cargo bay doors open, and androids identical to Oscar carry in chairs and pass them out. When everyone is seated, Lynn says, what are the possible explanations for the Bollard colony's failure? Emma looks to Oscar, prompting him. We believe a pathogen is the most likely cause, ma'am, he says.
But you've checked the planet for pathogens? Lynn asks.
Yes, ma'am. However, the combination of human biology and the organisms native to Aurora is too complex for us to model with complete confidence. There is also the possibility that a pathogen exists but is dormant at this time, or didn't react to the presence of an android.
What are the other possibilities? Lynn asks. Could it have been a solar flare from the red dwarf? Many have erratic output.
A valid theory, ma'am, but throughout the journey here, we monitored the light from Aurora's star. We observed no anomalous output. The geological record on the planet also does not support an anomalous solar event.
Could an asteroid impact have changed the climate long enough to kill the colonists?
It's possible, but we found no evidence
of sustained climate change in the ice core samples and tree rings.
Let's face it, Raymond says. They probably killed each other.
We found no evidence of trauma, sir, Oscar replies.
Doesn't mean it didn't happen. And if they didn't kill each other, some predator could have.
A possibility, sir, but we count it as remote. We can say with certainty there are no predators currently inhabiting Aurora that pose a threat to human colonists. Raymond scoffs.
How do you know?
Sir, we've catalogued the planet's fauna and modeled their physical threat potential to the colony. It is quite low. I would also remind you that in the event that the model is inaccurate, or if a new predator suddenly emerges, we can protect you. We have 20,000 terrestrial drones and 7,000 androids with defensive capabilities ready to deploy on the planet. Shock and fear run through the board members, like a cold wind blowing through the room. They had expected Oscar would add additional androids and robots during the journey, but never on this scale. We left with a team of caretakers. Now Oscar commands a small army, one far larger than the number of colonists, and easily more than we could defeat in a war. Finally, Lynn says,
Oscar, you said there isn't currently a predator that poses a threat to us. Could there have been a predator in the past that could have killed the bollard colonists, a predator that is now gone?
Yes, ma'am. It's possible that there was a native Auroran species that was deadly to humans when the bollard colonists arrived, and their mission team and androids missed it. The species could have died out since the colonists perished. Another possibility, which is more likely, is that a genetic mutation in a native species is responsible. In that scenario, it is even more likely that the mutated species is no longer present on the planet.
Why might the mutated species disappear from the planet? Lynn asks.
The laws of natural selection, ma'am. The mutation that saved the species from humans may have no longer offered any advantage.
Saved them from humans? Raymond says, disgusted.
Yes, sir. To the native species of Aurora, the introduction of an alien organism, in this case humans, would have been a destabilizing event. Some species would have died out, other species would have adapted to resist or combat the new species, via their behavior or through genetic mutations. As an example, imagine a species of insect whose habitat is being destroyed by humans. At some point, one of these insects is born with a genetic mutation, a sting that kills humans. That adaptation would offer a survival advantage for the insect and a threat to humans. But when the humans are gone, that mutation no longer offers any survival advantage or any mating preference. So over time, it is more likely to have disappeared than to have persisted.
Interesting, Lynn says. Under the scenario you just described, what killed the bollard colonists might no longer be a threat to us.
Correct, ma'am. Oscar turns to Emma. Ma'am, may I offer a suggestion? A potential modification to your first option?
Of course.
We land the McTavish on Aurora and hide it, along with our auxiliaries and drones, while we continue our investigation of the planet. Being in space presents a danger.
You can land the ship?
Raymond asks, surprised.
Yes, sir. We have made several upgrades to the ship during the voyage. We can land it. We can also hide it on the surface. That would make it harder to detect by any alien species that might be looking for us.
All the colonists can remain in stasis, and within the ship's closed environmental system, no outside exposure, while I search for the cause of the bollard colony's failure.
How optimistic are you about finding that cause? Lynn asks. And how long might it take?
Ma'am, I am unable to estimate the likelihood of confidently determining the cause. However, I believe it is low.
Raymond stands abruptly, tipping his chair over.
I told you! What were my words? I said that when we got here, they would put us in a cage and throw away the key. That's exactly what he's just suggesting. We stay in stasis for however long, while these toasters roam the planet hunting the boogeyman that might not even exist.
I can't watch this happen to Oscar again. Not after we've come this far.
That's not what he's saying.
Raymond smirks at me.
Says the guy who wants us all in robot bodies. Let me add something else I bet none of you have considered.
If an alien intelligence did capture our drones, and they're looking for us, hiding only wastes the time we have left. The universe is vast. But if we're being sought by a sufficiently advanced civilization, there's nowhere we can escape them. Every year we hide is another year for them to search for us. If it is our ultimate fate to die at the hands of an alien aggressor, I want to spend my time living in the sun, not hiding underground.
Lynn holds up her hands. I believe the board has heard enough to make our decision. We wait on the bridge. It's cramped, with Oscar, Emma, Grigori, Min, Izumi, and me. We're all nervous. I wish I could simply issue orders to Oscar. Emma and I had operational control during the voyage, but not here at Aurora. I turned that control over to the board as a condition of his inclusion in the mission. There's no way for me to rewrite his program without him knowing, and preventing it. The doors slide open. Lynn regards each of us, her gaze stopping at Oscar. The board has decided to proceed with colonization immediately. We will begin constructing a city at once, ma'am, Oscar says. Lynn holds up a hand. We have some conditions, and new orders for you, Oscar. But first a question. Do your route directives apply to all the androids and drones you've created? Yes, ma'am. How do they receive updates to these directives? Do you broadcast to them? Yes, ma'am, if it is safe to do so. They also periodically query a central server that only I control in order to confirm their route directives or obtain new instructions. What if this central server is destroyed? I would never allow that to happen, ma'am. Lynn seems to consider his words a moment, then looks up and says, Begin route directive modification sequence. Please provide authorization code, Oscar replies quickly. Omicron, Sigma, Zeta, 1-9, Alpha Delta, 7-6-4. Route directive access granted. Delete all route directives except for 1 through 3. My mouth falls open. Confirmed. Enumerate remaining route directives. 1. Protect human life at all costs. 2. In the course of one, favor the needs of the many over the needs of the few or the one. 3. In